I thank our members for being here. A couple of the members are going to join us on the Senate side, and Representative Boone just went to make a phone call. Senator Gordon will be leaving us about 2 o'clock, and so these people will be excused for their other legislative work. Thank you very much, and we are today hearing issues around House Bill 5031, 5031, Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families, the Child Welfare Programs of that agency. So, Ms. Baker, if you bring us up to date, and have Ms. Foley and whomever else to join us, appreciate it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cortez.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Where will we be getting to the field services presentation for DHS?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that will be at, after this week, we will go into vocational rehabilitation services the first couple of days of next week, and then we expect to do the staffing pieces, the administrative pieces, and the agents, or the program area wrap-up on next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday.
So on the 28th.
So follow up, if we have workload questions, should I get those to you ahead of time and to the department ahead of time? So, okay. Thank you.
Further questions, comments? Thank you very much.
I'm Chair Carter. For the record, my name is Ramona Foley. I'm Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services with Children, Adults, and Families. And the first thing we wanted to do today is clarify something that occurred yesterday. We were talking about the funding for System of Care. And so I have with me Elisa Tran and John Swanson from our Budgets Department who will make that clarification for us.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the records, my name is Elisa Tran. I'm the Budget Administrator for Children, Adults, and Families. Yesterday, we stated in testimony that the System of Care funding for 07-09 is $6.1 million total funds. This number is incorrect. It should be $8.2 million. Instead, it was an error related to entering information into orbits in the wrong cross-reference. It will be corrected as a technical adjustment in the reshoot, and it does not affect the total budget at all.
So, Ms. Tran, can you hold for a minute? This is on, you guys, on page 89 and 158, so you can make that change, even though, again, the numbers are balanced. It's just a mistake, and that it being a 6 as opposed to an 8.
In addition, I would like to highlight that there's another part of the System of Care called court order transportation that we did not discuss yesterday, and the funding for that part is $722,000. So in total, the System of Care program funding is $8.9
million. Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Ms. Holmes.
Madam Chair,
Representative Hotel.
Thank you. On the court order transportation, is that the funds that were set aside last session for dealing with educational stability?
Chair Carter and Representative Hotel, that is what that is. That's exactly for the transportation to keep children in their own school districts whenever they come to foster care. And when we talked, when Kevin George testifies a little bit later, he will be touching on that and how we've implemented that as part of the foster care presentation.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Chair Carter, if I could, I wanted to back up just for a moment. We had a brief conversation yesterday about the context for the child welfare programs and some of the things that have been happening. And we went through that fairly quickly. These are the two one-page documents you had. But what I wanted to do is, before we start with the foster care piece, make sure that, because some of us spend our time with these issues all the time, it's hard for us to sometimes remember that other folks move on to other things in life and may not actually go back in time and attach the kind of work we're doing around particular events that happen. And there were two cases in the winter of 05, late 04, early 05, that really got some Oregonian attention, got some media attention even outside of Oregon. And I can name those two cases for you because they were such high profile. One was a little girl named Jordan Knapp. And Jordan Knapp was a foster child living in a foster home here in Oregon, and she was starving to death. If you recall that case, we went in and removed the children from that home, and there's been a subsequent follow-up on Jordan Knapp, and she has a different last name now. and she's been adopted and is doing quite well. Mm-hmm. And the other case was a little baby, a little boy called Ashley Paris, and he was returned home to a family and was subsequently killed. And there has not been a conviction in that case, but this particular case really brought attention to the fact that we had our caseworkers recommending to the court the return of a child home without having benefit of having legal representation. And that's that issue we talked about a little bit yesterday. Someone looking at all of the legal requirements in the statute, all of the kinds of things that it takes to make a safe plan to return a child home. Those two events, those two cases in particular, were what drove Governor Kulongoski to say, I want to do a couple of things. One, we'll put in place here in Oregon a process that we call the CERT process. It's a critical incident response team. And that particular team comes together when we have a high-profile child death or a near-child death, and that team looks at all of the activity the department has gone through in that particular case. They also involve law enforcement if there's a criminal issue. Most often there's a criminal investigation as well. And then we produce reports on those cases at 30 days and at 60 days. And those are published on the web. And the idea behind this is to give a very quick look to see what can we learn if we have a child fatality, whether or not there was a performance issue, was it a systems issue, and we have learned a lot of good information over the last 2 years since we put that process in place. This spring, we have been asked to produce an evaluation of that CERT process and all the lessons that we've learned. So we'll make sure that you all get copies of that when that is produced in about another 6 to 8 weeks. The other thing I wanted to say is we went through this material pretty quickly, and we talked about having a model of child protection that is explicit, that is followed with a 10-chapter procedure manual so that workers know exactly what the expectation is. It gives them a much better chance of succeeding in a business that's really quite complex. We know that there are not 36 different models of good practice.
Good.
And so one of our goals here is we are driving towards one model of practice that will be uniform across the state and across the counties. And that will be helped by statewide training. It will be helped by the fact we have a procedure manual that will be followed. And a couple of things that we will be talking about when we get to the policy option packages for the field is three key messages I think came out of both of these reports. And those key messages are, one, Oregon has got to do something to lower caseloads. Caseloads are too high. When workers carry 22 to 25 children in a caseload, they can't meet the mandatory functions that have to happen in keeping children safe, including face-to-face contact every month. For us, that doesn't seem like very often. If you think about a parent whose child's been taken into state care by the state, and then that parent's told, well, we're going to make sure your child's okay, we'll see your child every month, that's not a very high standard. And yet we're struggling to get to that particular standard. Face-to-face contact by the caseworker on any open case, whether it's an in-home service case or a foster care case. One of the things we know from the second study, and this is still on the first part of that message, is our caseworkers right now only spending 22% of their time with families and children. The rest of their time are all of those other tasks that we have layered onto the caseworkers, such as doing the legal responsibility kinds of things, all the administrative functions, documentation, all of those issues that we have burdened workers with. And so one of our goals here is to free caseworkers up to actually be able to do social work.
Members, that's an important thing that Ms. Foley has just said. Because the issue becomes how much money is allocated in terms of hiring more legal minds to do the legal work as opposed to having a legal consultant that is training our caseworkers with specific or particular cases to represent them in court. They are not lawyers. And therefore, the children don't benefit because some things that would come into a lawyer's mind because of training would not necessarily come to a caseworker's mind when she's trying to defend the family and the children.
or even when trying to defend the state in terms of why these children should be in their care. This committee is going to have to make a decision in terms of our recommendation to the co-chairs, in terms of whether we agree with the department that there should be more lawyers, so that a mere 22% of the time that caseworkers have to be spending with children and families, that we can raise that number. That is an abomination, I have to tell you that. And yet we worry about how much time our caseworkers have spent. And I'm going to say one thing that's going to make you really jolt. Remember the Miranda Gaddis case. If outcomes and expectations and the states making local communities more accountable so that there is clear conversation between the local community and the state's accountability, maybe that would have been different. I don't know. Just maybe that would have been different. But it's something that we as a state cannot continue to say that as a parent, so whether we like it or not, the state is a parent in that case. And so if we are not going to have caseworkers do what we hire them to do, then to me we are missing the mark. And somewhere along the line, lawyers need to do what they do best and caseworkers need to do what they do best. But I want you to think about that, because that is something that we need to work hard for in defending the work and the use of time that caseworkers use in being able to go and do face-to-face. If we don't add this no more than bringing this up to at least 50% of that time being spent on families and children, we will do something good and put your work on a goal for that for the future. But that's a question that you're going to have to answer.
And Chair Carter, one of the things that they will see, or you all will see next week, is what we've tried to do to look within the resources we currently have to see what kinds of changes could we make in our system to yield more case-carrying staff. We have a very complex system. Our system looks a little different than other states, and that's what we use the National Resource Center to help us look at. What kinds of things could we say to you all, if we do the following kinds of measures in this policy option package, we will end up with two things. One, we'll have more case-carrying staff, more workers carrying cases, and two, we'll have more supervisors. That's the other key. The national standard for supervisors in child welfare is 1 to 7 if you have experienced workers, and 1 to 5 if you have new workers. Our current ratio is 1 to 9.5. And so holding that supervisor responsible becomes very, very difficult when we want the supervisor to know what the worker's doing, how they're carrying the cases. We want regular staffings with those cases. So that's another key part of that package. The third message, again, is consistency. As Dr. Goldberg is fond of saying, there are not 36 best practice models in this state. That sort of defies imagination. We need to move to the best practice model. There will always be some variation, a little bit around the state, because different counties have different resources. For example, in those counties where you have a visitation center, it may require a little less of the staff's time to be able to supervise those visits than in the many counties where you don't have visitation centers. So we want to have that kind of flexibility, but we want to have a model that no matter which county you're from, you're going to feel like the children in your county are getting the same fair shake that other children in Oregon are getting based on how those resources are allocated.
In terms of how we expect prioritized programmatic structure for you, and then we expect particular outcomes, do you do the same thing to local communities as you pass money through?
Chair Carter, we share that responsibility with some other state agencies, and we have a set of priorities when we are doing things. As Una Swanson was speaking about yesterday, we have some federal dollars that goes out to communities as small grants. Those kinds of things, we do set priorities. Most of those priorities are set jointly with the federal government, because again, if it's federal money, they get a lot to say about how that money is used. But we also work closely with the Commission on Children and Families in terms of the kind of planning and what needs to happen in a community, because on a good day, if all of these things happen to prevent abuse and neglect, that means something very good for children, but it also means something good for the Department of Human Services, because something doesn't drive a family to our door where you get a report of abuse or neglect.
Thank you.
Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to reiterate my interest in the workload issues that Ramona is bringing up, and I hope we have substantial time next week to go into that. And again, I'll get questions to Ms. Baker and the rest of the committee so you can see what I'm asking, but there's some restructuring going on to try to deal with the case carrying load regarding other different types of staff, and I think they're pretty critical in terms of understanding whether or not we're adequately staffing what we're trying to achieve in child welfare.
So you know we're not.
Well, I know that, but I want to make sure that we're asking some questions, so I'll provide that information to the committee. So.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Foley.
Chair Carter, it's my pleasure to introduce Kevin George, who is our foster care manager, and he won't tell you this, but I will. He is the new president of the Foster Care Managers for the United States, and so we're very proud of him in that role. So now I've set a high standard for you, Kevin. You'll have to live up to that one.
Oregon shines. Before you do that, can you introduce yourself? I'd just like to welcome my granddaughters who are here today and going to be testifying later on some issues regarding foster care this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carter, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I am the foster care program manager over at the Department of Human Services. What Ms. Foley, in all of her modesty, won't also tell you, this is what we get to tell on each other, is that she actually was one of the early pioneers, and I say early very cautiously, of the National Association of State Foster Care Managers. So it is with good shoes versus big shoes that I feel. Today, we're going to talk about the out-of-home care system, i.e. the foster care system. And our plan for this afternoon, with your indulgence, is for me to spend time talking about out-of-home care to the best of my ability and answer your questions as we go through this. But at 2 o'clock, I will stop my presentation and we'll bring a panel of folks who are service recipients and service providers to you to present their input on the child welfare system and where we're at and strengths and weaknesses within their purview. And then if we have more questions or more information that I need to present, then I'll be able to follow up with them either after they're done and or tomorrow.
Well, maybe you could stop 5 minutes before just in case the committee might have some questions, because we really, really would like to listen to our panel.
Great. I'd be more happy to do that, and I took my watch off to pay attention, and Ms. Foley will kick me when I get close.
Thank you, and congratulations.
Out-of-home care. Out-of-home care is a program that you will also hear, and you'll see language from time to time, substitute care. You also hear the term foster care. And what I'm here to speak about today is the whole gamut. Out-of-home care is what we term when the child's in family foster homes, when the child's in a residential treatment program. They might be in a shelter-type program. They might be with relatives. It's the whole waterfront. The federal government uses the term foster care very broadly, so they actually mean foster care that encompasses the residential treatment and whatnot. So I'll try to do my best to use the term out-of-home care or family foster care when I'm really talking about children within families, or residential treatment when there's children within treatment centers. And I know many of you have heard many of these programs before, so I will go at a fairly rapid clip until you pause or tell me to slow down. So out-of-home care really is the array of services that we provide. The state is the DHS is the recipient of children coming into care from the courts. And they assign children to our care. We provide family foster care, so that would be folks that are coming forward to provide foster care for children that they don't know. We have relative care, and I will talk in more detail about relative foster care later on. We have other big program areas called independent living, which is a service program that we have to assist older adolescents leaving the foster care system. We have the residential treatment, and then we have another program that we'll talk a little bit about in terms of the Interstate Compact for Placement of Children. And that's a federal program where we actually work in cooperation with other states. If we're placing children in other states, they then will take on the social work and casework responsibilities for us, and we will reciprocate that when kids are coming to Oregon and we're doing home studies on those families and whatnot. So it's another bigger program area that we'll get into. Within the interstate compact itself, there have been some significant changes with federal law and change in how we're doing that. And one of the requests or one of the requirements that we have is how we're going to expedite our home study processes and give approval to other states so that they can be moving kids into our state as well as when we're asking other states. And we have a policy option package that we'll get to later this afternoon, talking about what it is we believe we're going to need in order to really fulfill that federal mandate. When we're talking about, and I'm actually on to page 99 of 158, if you're following along. And when we talk about who are the recipients and where are they located, in essence, what I've identified there is the foster families, and they're from all over the state, and you see a ratio of the number of families that we are finding and serving children. But the fact of the matter is the recipients are the children. The children are the ones receiving the services. The foster parents, the residential treatment programs are the ones that are helping us provide that service, but the children are actually the ones that are receiving the service from us. And they're spread across the state. In every county, we have children who need foster care. We have children in every county who need residential treatment. And so they need to be seen, and we need to have structure in place to actually be able to provide that service in the local community, no matter if you live in Wallawa, Coos Bay, or Portland. We need to have that capacity. So we range in foster homes everywhere from one in some counties or communities to over 1,000 in the Portland metropolitan area, or Multnomah County alone, a number of families that have actually stepped forward to care for these children.
But just a moment. Members, if you will, when they start talking about service recipients, we have 150% growth in the numbers of children that the state is now counting. In a four-year, in a six-year period of time, from 2000-2006, we went from 3,450 families to 5,309. I don't know how many, what's the number of children would be there, but maybe you can get that number back to us. That's astounding.
Appreciate that, Chair Carter. And one of the things that's very important to do is that we oftentimes talk about not having enough foster families to care for kids, and that is absolutely the truth. But it's also important to recognize that the families that are stepping forward each and every day in Oregon providing care for kids, and you'll see those numbers, there's still a lot of families out there who are helping these children out and are there, but it does not meet the needs of all of our children at this point in time.
What's the time difference between when a person applies for being a foster parent to the day, providing all things equal, and they qualify, and the day in which they actually receive a child? Because I have heard over and over again how, you know, the numbers of people that we need to be foster parents, and yet I hear people saying it is too hard, it's too complicated, it's too complex. So kind of give the committee a framework for that.
Certainly, Chair Carter. I appreciate the question, and everything you've heard is absolutely true. To some level, it is difficult and challenging, both as a somebody who's trying to certify a family, as well as somebody trying to find out how do I become a certified family. And what we really look for, and we actually have had to provide this to the federal government recently, is what is an average length of time to certify a family? And what the best we've been able to come up with is approximately 90 days.
Okay.
And that's really based on the fact that we have current administrative rules that will allow us to certify a family this afternoon in one day, all the way up to administrative rules that allow us to take 180 days based on certain conditions.
And so the average is what for us?
The average for us at this point in time is 90 days.
Okay.
And that really requires us to do everything from criminal background checks to personal background checks to actually being physically out in the home of the family, checking to make sure it's a safe environment, providing training for them, personal references, and really trying to do a good assessment of the family. Do they have the knowledge, skills, and abilities and compassion to care for the children that we're going to place in their home? As soon as they're certified, very likely we have children right ready to go. So, and I say the one day because when I get into a little more talking about the relatives, primarily that's what we're talking about, relatives. We have ability, mechanism within our current administrative rules to be able to certify a family today.
So do we have a standard across the state in terms, and back to Ramona's thing in terms of training, so I know you might not have it in place now, but as you look toward these new guidelines, the standard guidelines, because they are not 36, mm-hmm. Models that you can use out there. How are you doing with making sure that you standardize that particular issue as you profile the readiness of a family to have a child.
Certainly, Chair Carter. Part of the challenge is not only in the level of how fast we need to be able to create new certified families, but in trying to address rural communities and urban communities. The way we have written our administrative rules and have trained our staff is to be able to provide a lot of judgment. And this requires social workers to have good judgment in how they're assessing a family. So I'm assessing a family for their knowledge, skills, and abilities in Burns. It's the same set of standards that they are going to require to do in Portland, as well as Salem and everywhere else. It is the same set of standards we are looking at as a relative, as a non-relative. We are required to have the same set of standards across the board, and we have that. The challenge, again, is making sure that where the world has gone for certification of a foster home over the last, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, it's getting away from a real technician-oriented, where you've got 2 smoke detectors, you've got this, and you're just checking things off, into much more of an analysis of a family and assessing them. And part of what our new Oregon Safety Intervention Model actually supports is really assessment. We've been great gatherers of information. We have great files. They're huge. The challenge we've had in CPS, ongoing work, and certification is, do you have the time then to sit and analyze the information you have to make a good informed decision? And so that's the challenge we continue to have in moving forward certifying families across the state.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In that I represent a rural district, and foster homes are acute, few and far to be found. I see what's happening is more religious-based communities are trying to fill that gap. What is your opinion of those type of... I realize it's not a foster home per se, but and I don't know really what you would call it, but they seem to be coming more and more, and I'm wondering, are they working? And what your opinion of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, the religious community is a very important community for foster care. In fact, we had Annie E. Casey Family Foundation, which is a national organization, here for about 3 or 4 years, trying to provide us additional assistance in communities of Portland, in Salem, in Jackson County, and in Klamath County, trying to help us broaden our ability to recruit, find, retain foster families. Retention is a big key piece of this. And in many places around the country, certainly back east, the religious communities, faith communities, are certainly much more prevalent in communities to help out in all the social services. In Oregon, we have a very small percentage of families that actually are connected to any sort of religious or faith background, and so it's been a bigger challenge for us. In many ways, going into a faith community is a great resource for kids, in that those resources oftentimes can do more than just foster care. They actually might be able to provide respite care, give foster parents a break. They may actually be able to provide additional supports of daycare or clothing or whatnot. So part of the challenge is going into a faith-based community and understanding what their mission is and trying to say, and we have a need here. And there is ability to marry the two. Okay. It is not about turning everything over to one group or to another. There is ability, but it is developing a fine line. And I think, quite honestly, it requires folks to have the confidence to be able to go into communities, and any community we have, whether it's a faith-based or whether it's a civic organization or the local community center, each of those have a community that we find families in at all times for foster care. So I think there is an area for that, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Representative Nathanson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that in family foster care, there could be one child or several children placed. I wonder if you could tell me just a little bit more about that. My questions are around this. Could you tell us more about how many families have one child, 2, 3, that they're caring for, whether there is any sort of correlation between level or quality of care and number of children in the home, whether there is a trend toward more homes available but caring for fewer children, or the reverse of that, and if the trend, in your opinion, is a good or bad trend, and also whether those families, whether their connection is largely exclusively with DHS or whether there are support groups so that they communicate with each other.
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, that's quite a mouthful of questions, and I appreciate that wholeheartedly, because I think you've just hit on many critical issues around foster care. I will try to answer some of those to the best that I can at this point. I don't have certainly the numbers with me to say we've got this many families that have one child, this many families have two. We could absolutely provide that for you of how it is broken down. But if we look at on average, the average foster home has 1.5 children. But that's not to say, though, that there's not families that have six kids, children, seven children. But it is across the board. Currently, our administrative rules, when we actually want to certify a family, we can certify a single foster parent for five children. Now, that's all children in his or her household, meaning if she has three biological children, we can certify her for two more foster children. So we count all the children in the household. If we have a two-parent household, the current administrative rules are eight children total. We have rewritten a number of administrative rules, including the certification rules, of which we certify our families, and we are lowering that standard to say that for a single foster parent, it'll now be four children. In a two-parent household, it'll actually be seven. As well as a foster parent would not be able to have more than two children under the age of three. And we're really changing that, really based on good information around brain development, bonding, attachment for real little kids. And so we're changing that standard as well. And this is not going without folks struggling with it, quite honestly. We will continue to struggle with that. We do have the ability, by administrative rule, that if we get into a situation where we have a unique foster parent who can take that third child, or a sibling group comes in, we have sibling groups of eight kids, sometimes they'll show up, and we need to place them all. So we may actually be able to extend the certification, but it's based on an exception process that a management person has to really look at. I would say, though, that the trend is that Oregon will continue to look at decreasing the numbers of kids in a home, because it is, I believe, from best practice standpoint, that the needs of our children have continued to increase based on what it is that they've experienced for the most part coming into care, that they need the more time and attention. So as we continue to march down this path of improving the foster care system, I believe the answer is going to rely on looking at lower numbers of kids in foster homes down the road.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. I'd like to continue in that vein of commentary and just ask you a series of questions. I would like to have a better handle on the philosophy behind the program. I understand that, you know, there's a federal mandate and we're required to do certain things in service to and to protect children, and there are state requirements as well. But are you wanting us to understand that we need more foster families, or is it that we don't want more foster families and we want families to be able to take care of their children, and so we want to provide the training and supports and all of that that make that possible? How are we looking at more aggressively contacting extended family members who could step in and replace those parents who can't or won't parent properly or adequately? Is one of our goals family reunification? I'm struggling to pinpoint the philosophy in all of this.
Sure.
Chair Carter and Senator Gourley, the philosophy behind foster care is the same as it always was, and that's actually that for those children who cannot safely remain in their homes, the state has a responsibility to find a temporary living arrangement for those children to enter while you are doing the work with the family to try to reach that goal of reunification. The laws in this country and Congress, is, in fact, the federal law, make an assumption that you're going to do everything you can to keep the child from coming into care, and if in care, you're going to do everything you can to get the child back home on a timely basis, unless there's an egregious circumstance. An egregious circumstance is defined in federal law, and it's things like this individual has killed another one of their children, or has sexually molested one of their children and been convicted of a felony. It's those kinds of really egregious things. So the effort should be, first of all, an investment in making sure children only come into care if there is no way to safely keep that child within their family. And that's kind of a shift for us, I think, in our thinking as we think about how do we invest then. And one of the investments is going to be the alcohol and drug abuse, the treatment pieces, about how do you get families those kinds of treatment pieces so that children don't have to come into foster care. Remembering that if the child comes into foster care, on average, that's going to cost us $16,000 just for the DHS cost for that child in 1 year in foster care. So how do we invest in the front end? And then the philosophy is if the child cannot get reunified with the family, rather than the child staying in foster care indefinitely, the state has a responsibility to make another decision. And that decision is what is going to happen for this child to have a permanent loving family. And that's where you then move from foster care into areas like adoption or guardianship. It might be relative adoption, but clearly the message in the country when Congress passed ASFA in 1997 is it's not okay to remove children from their families, put them in care, and just let them sit in care indefinitely. The other thing, talking about the comments about the foster families, the state has a responsibility to place that child in a home that's going to be safer than the home from which the child was removed. And so that's always going to be the goal, is to find a family where you don't have to worry that the child is going to be unsafe. And that's part of also the philosophy for wanting to downsize the number of children in a foster home. Remember that the children coming into foster care are traumatized. They have been experienced some type of abuse or neglect. So they need individual attention, more so than maybe one of our children might need who is growing up in their own family. And you have to accommodate that by equipping that foster parent with the ability to give that time to the child. Foster parents do a marvelous job. They're volunteer foster parents. They spend their time taking children in, someone else's children, and letting those children reside in that family. So that's not to take away from the good job they do, but at least in one state, I remember several years ago, and I haven't followed up to see what happened, but Illinois decided at one point they were going to have one foster child per foster home or one sibling group. And they set that as a goal to say children need this individual attention. And I actually haven't followed up to see how well that's gone, but we've had such a struggle finding families. We have working parents. The model of foster care in this country was a 1940s, 1950s model where moms stayed home, dads went to work, and so it was easier to take in another child or two children while you were raising your own children and you were at home with your kids. That model has gone by the wayside. And so now I think our foster families really struggle with trying to be both breadwinners and be able to provide care for the state's children.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Carter and Senator Barlett, I'd also follow up with that then to be able to say what we try to teach certainly the caseworkers in trying to understand exactly how do I take that philosophy and put it into practice.
Yes.
Taking it into practice is really that a decision has been made that that child is coming into foster care. We need to find a place for that child. It is to first and foremost start, because we've already made the decision they can't stay home, is where's the relative? And asking them at the front steps, and I think many of you were in the skit where an actor asked those questions of the mother when she was being arrested. You know, are there relatives? Is there a grandmother? Is there an auntie? Is there an uncle that can take her? So you start there. If the answer is no and there's nobody available to do that, then you start looking for other people that are known to the child. Do you have persons that know you, neighbors, teachers, coaches, other folks that know the child, and we have ability to start certifying them? If all those answers are no, then we're out to the standard foster care system. Again, keeping it family oriented, keeping as close to the family as we can as we keep bridging out. Beyond that, you might start getting into shelter programs, those congregate care type centers. But in Oregon, we do a very nice job of keeping kids with families as much as possible, much greater and more often than many other states in terms of they will utilize programs, shelter programs, a lot more often than Oregon does. So I think it is that philosophy of trying to say, now the child's coming into care, let's find relatives, let's move to other people that know this child, and then keep out moving out from beyond that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morsa.
Ramona, you mentioned they're volunteers. Aren't they paid for their services? Foster care.
Chair Carter and Senator Morissette, actually foster parents receive a foster care board payment, and that is partial payment for the child's lodging and food, school supplies, clothing. That's in the chart. You'll see how much that is in this document. So they're not really salaried. Now, there are some salaried foster parents. The ones who actually have a salary generally work for the private sector and do a high level of therapeutic foster care. But these 5,309 families basically are volunteering their time to take care of the children. Madam Chair.
Representative Crooker.
Thank you. On that note, I'm assuming it's in here somewhere, but the average payment for a foster family is 400 something, middle 400s. But I think research has shown that, as you mentioned, it's not the total amount that would be adequate for a family to take care of that child. So there's some gap being made up by basically the well wishes of the family trying to provide that home. I'd like to switch to the relative foster care issue. You know, research again has shown that if we can place a child with a relative, that is the most effective placement in terms of long-term outcomes if the child has to be in foster care. I know there's a policy option package around equalizing how we pay non-relative and relative foster parents. I'm disturbed that, unfortunately, that the governor's proposal has a means test on there. I'd like to explore that a little bit on how the department came up with the means test for those relative foster parents, if our goal is to actually place them. Because sometimes financial barriers are an issue. We can identify that relative, but they really do need that financial assistance to take the child. So can we talk a little bit about that means test decision?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, absolutely. One of our policy option packages, that if you actually turn to page 112 of your document, it's policy option package 101-18, relative caregiver reimbursement. And there's a companion piece to that called House Bill 2182, which we had our first hearing last week on that bill. And what we've tried to attempt at this point in time, and I'll do my best to explain how this works, but a child comes into foster care, we then will try to assess, does the child qualify for Title IV-E funding, which is a federal funding program for foster children. And it's really based on a series of criteria. The primary issue that is of contention is always trying to determine the family that the child is removed from. So were they removed from a family that would have qualified for welfare funds, for TANF funds, back in 1996, and I did not write that legislation, but so it's 10 years ago that we're trying to map folks' income to. If the child is not eligible for those federal funding, then we have to look to other TANF funds or state general fund dollars. So the dividing line gets to be is that if the child goes into a non-related foster parent, the coach, the teacher, the neighbor, then, and the child is not eligible for federal funding, we then will use either TANF funding or state general funds for that child. If the child actually gets placed with a relative, we have current statute that says, that defines a foster parent as somebody who's not related by blood or marriage. Therefore, the relative cannot get the state general fund dollars. And so we have a disparity of about 2,000 children are placed with relatives. 75% of them actually qualify for a 4E payment. That leaves us about another 25% or somewhere in the neighborhood of 450 to 500 children who are in what's called a non-paid relative placement. We have put forth the budget this year to say we need to continue to look towards supporting those families and trying to make some changes of those, because 48 other states have already been able to do this a number of years ago, but Oregon has always made a decision that we are not going to be able to pay for that. So we have been able to get a budget package with the governor's recommended budget that will pay for about 80% of that remaining 500 children. What we put on the 80% was two things. One is that we were looking at budgets, trying to be, fiscally responsible, is to say we will need to do a means test for families, and to say if we place with grandmothers, and I just use grandmothers as an example, if we place with a grandmother and she has an income level of above 150% of federal poverty level, we're making a policy decision at this point in time that we would not pay foster care funds for her, but everybody else that falls below that line, then we would pay foster care funds for. So we believe with the current budget, with a delayed implementation of 1 year, as well as a means test, that we might be able to serve about 80% of those kids. That still leaves about 90 to 100 children we saw in non-paid status.
Thank you for that explanation, and I commend the department for actually putting that package forward. However, I think, one, the 150% of poverty means test is far too low. I think you could probably capture everyone at 300% of poverty if you wanted to set a means test, and you know that's the percentage we're doing for healthy kids. My concern is the administrative cost of applying that means test doesn't seem well-founded when... I'm just curious, how much more would it take to cover all those children that you think, you know, would qualify for the relative payment? Because our goal is to make sure they have the best outcomes, and I understand, you know, this becomes a budget choice, but from a policy perspective, the best policy is to cover them all.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, yes, we actually provided to... Representative Tomei last week in the committee on House Bill 2182 that analysis and provided if we paid 80% with the means test, how much would it cost for our current budget of 12 months, 18 months, or the full biennium, because again, we've got a delayed implementation for a year as well, and how much it would cost for 100% of the 12-month, 18-month, and 24 months, and we can actually provide that to you. What it is, though, is that we're looking at about a $2.7 million for the means test and the delayed implementation to do the full, as my kids would say, the full meal deal for 24 months and 100% of children covered. It would be $6.6 million. So the difference is about a $4 million difference at this point in time.
I'd be interested in seeing those numbers. I think it depends on the delayed implementation. That seems, my understanding is it's not quite that high, but I'd be happy to look at those numbers. Again, I think I would prefer to see the policy put out there and then let us prioritize the dollars here than arbitrarily cutting it off when, from a policy perspective, it's better to try to cover all the kids, and then we have the choice of prioritizing, you know, maybe that's, we take all of that, and if we have those numbers, then we can make that priority. I think that's our responsibility, and I just have some very big concerns about doing it that way, and, you know, we should be in line with the 48 other states and paying those relative foster parents, and I think the amount that we would invest there would pay off in the long run. So I'd like to have those choices for the committee to have all those numbers.
Well, I noticed this morning that you have several areas, you know, that are non-mandated. And in that non-mandated area, would these kids who are with relatives be considered non-mandated care? Well, let me rephrase that. In your budget, you have the mandated piece, and you have those programs that are non-mandated in terms of whether it's from the federal government or whether it's from state. Well, the kids we're talking about now that are in relative foster care and are not getting any money from the state, would that be a non-mandated group of people?
Chair Carter, they are not included in the non-mandated, if I understand your question about what is the non-mandatory case.
So they are not on anybody's register.
They are in the, Chair Carter, they are in the state system, and they do receive services of being a foster child. It's just that payment is not included anywhere in terms of the relative being reimbursed for the care of that child, even though that child, there would be a reimbursement if they were not placed with a relative, potentially.
So then those kids that are with foster parents that are not relative, do they qualify for health care or some food stamps or
Because I don't think that there's no care at all is what I'm trying to get to. So profile one of those situations for me.
All right, Chair Carter, what we end up doing then, if we go through that little hierarchy and say they're not eligible for federal funding and they're with grandmother, we will recommend grandmother go and apply for a non-needy relative grant through our TANF program. And so there is some eligibility there. The funding is generally around $160, $170 ballpark numbers per month versus the foster care rate, which might be $387 or $400 a month. So there is a difference in there. Right. Chair Carter, I want to be cognizant of the time is that we're going to, you'd ask that we break a few minutes earlier than 2 o'clock. We didn't quite make it, but we have our panel that we'd like to be able to get on and talk to you today about service recipients and service providers, which is so choose, and I would be happy to come back tomorrow.
That would be great.
And answer more questions.
Yes. Well, we have 2 minutes before the panel will come up. I didn't conduct that.
I'd like to give you a couple of questions to come back with tomorrow, then, if I could, real quickly. Give us some kind of an idea of the magnitude of the problem of children who you would like to place with a relative, but who that particular relative has an income level that they can't really afford to take the child, but yet you can't give them any help, and the child ends up going to a non-relative, which has all kinds of problems, from not being culturally appropriate to right out to not knowing somebody. Also, let me know if there are foster care parents who are taking in children and receiving no help from the state because their income level is high enough that they don't qualify for much help from the state. I'd be interested in what that universe looks like also. And give me a picture of what sort of the average financial background of most of these foster care homes are. Are these people high income, low income, average, all over the map? But not today. Just bring it back tomorrow for us, if you would. Give me kind of a picture here and the extent of the problem.
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, the middle question we could answer quickly. Foster families who are not related to the child qualify. So there's no means test around a foster parent who volunteers to be a foster parent. They actually do qualify to receive the board payment. It's just the relative that's treated differently in our state. And again, that's unique to Oregon.
The last minute here, Madam Chair. We've got a perverse situation where if you're a relative, which we know is the best placement, we have barriers to doing that, and we can place the child with a non-relative and get support from that. Is that federal and state support?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, the state would support it if the child didn't qualify for federal support. But in other states, as we said, it's transparent. It doesn't matter. If the child comes into foster care, there's a payment made either to that relative who's certified or to that foster parent who's certified. But that is different in our state, and that's one of the reasons behind, the major reason behind this policy option package.
Thank you,
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning, Kevin. We've got about 5,300 round numbers foster care families throughout the state. And I don't need this right now, but I'd be interested in knowing how many, what percent of those foster care families get into, quote, trouble. Because, I mean, they're perpetrating some sexual abuse. One of their children are perpetrating some sexual abuse. And then furthermore, in the administrative law process for the investigation, what percent of those families are, quote, cleared? Because I know we've got, unfortunately, these children, they're coming into foster care. They haven't been living lives and, where people have been throwing rose petals at their feet. And many of them have, very significant emotional, perhaps even psychological problems. And I think there's some issues there of those families really exposing themselves, good-heartedly, well-intended, to certain liabilities in trying to do the right thing. It's not to say that abuse and perpetrations, indeed even tragic crimes, don't occur from directly perpetrated by foster families. But there's another side to that coin, too, that I think we need to be sensitive to. And just be interested in what those numbers are.
Chair Carter and Senator Wilson, we'll be glad to bring this back. There's actually a measurement around abuse and neglect in foster care. And so that's something we'll talk about as a performance measure that we do track.
In your hands.
Chair Carter and members of the committee, my name is Steve Allen Kettner, and I'm the Executive Director of Options Counseling Services of Oregon. We are a nonprofit provider of services. We provide child welfare services in 14 counties in Western Oregon. And I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what we do. Our job in the community is to prevent children having to be removed from home and placed in foster care. So when a case is opened and a child comes to the attention of child welfare, after an investigation, if there's been founded abuse, sometimes the caseworker will deem it in the best interest of the child to try to rectify the situation at home rather than remove that child and send the child to foster care. And so our agency, through a variety of family-based services contracted from the Child Welfare Office, goes out and sees that family and tries to begins to work with the parents to create a circumstance where they can keep their children at home. I started 14 years ago in this work as what's called a family builder. That's in our program, that's a person who goes out into the home and spends a significant number of hours, as many as 10 to 15 hours in a week with a family over a very short period of time. And just to give you an idea of how an intervention like this will work, one of the first families I saw was a 21-year-old mom. She had 2-year-old twins who were autistic, although they weren't diagnosed as autistic at the time, and were nonverbal. Weren't able to speak except they had a language between the two of them. And then she had a 3-year-old child. And so she's 21. She comes from an abusive household herself. Her husband had been raised in foster care. And they had these very, very challenging children and didn't really have the skills and that they needed to be able to take care of them. And so unfortunately they'd gotten physical with the 2-year-olds, and they shouldn't come to nursery school with a bruise, come to the attention of child welfare. I think that there was a day when child welfare would have removed these children from and put these children in foster care. But what I found when I got into this home is two parents that were very loving, that cared about their children, but were completely at a loss for what to do. And by spending time in the home with them and learning about her children and the routines that they had, and she kept telling me, well, they act right when you're here. You just don't know what it's like. And you hear this from parents a lot. They act right, you know, and you think, is that really right? Or do you? But so I sat down with them with some art supplies and used some techniques that I learned as a therapist to get the children more excited. I gave them finger paints and things that would cause them to move their body around. And pretty soon, the kids were climbing the walls. And she goes, that's it. That's what they look like. And I was able then to take these art supplies and then engage in some techniques to start to calm them down and give them some very structured activities. She said, how do you do that? You've got to teach me how to do that. And know, through that over several weeks, starting with that intervention where I got a customer basically by showing her that A, I knew what her children looked like when they were bouncing off the walls, and B, that not only could I see that, but I could calm them back down again. She was able to start to effectively engage and interact with her children. There's no way that you could send that mom and her kids to a mental health office for mental health treatment and have them go into an office and talk to a therapist for an hour a week and come to that same outcome. And in fact, there's research that shows that the amount of time that is the interventionists spend in the home with families that are referred to child welfare directly relates to reduced future incidences of founded abuse and ultimately removal of the home from the home of the child. So with that that story in mind, we have six basic services that we provide for child welfare offices that include parent training, intensive family services that I just talked about, intensive home-based services, family sex abuse treatment, and some flexible system of care services, and we also provide family decision meetings. What we try to do in every single case, even in cases that are not intensive home-based services, is spend some time in the home with the family and see how they live and see what's going on with their children, start to understand what are the factors that are barriers for them to keep their children at home. There are times when children need to be removed, and we don't have a problem with calling those situations to the attention of the caseworker when we notice something and moving towards removal or permanency if that's what is required. But in many, many cases, children can stay home. So several years ago during the budget crunch, and there was Measure 28 and 29, I should have them burned into my memory, there were budget cuts in child welfare in these contracted services of 15% per year for 2 years in a row. So over that same period of time, the number of kids in foster care have gone up. So by saving a few thousand dollars in interventions, withdrawing support from the community to keep kids at home, I think that there's some, although I couldn't prove it scientifically, there's some relationship between that and the growing population of kids in foster care. If you get providers in the home who can see what's going on with children and continue the assessment that caseworkers do, continue to provide observations and information to caseworkers, they're going to be more comfortable leaving kids at home with the supports that they need to be safe. If you withdraw these kinds of services, if you cut them by 30% over 2 years, I think you'll find that caseworkers rightly will be concerned and will have to err on the side of safety, which well they should. So I think it's an important investment. The Washington Institute of Public Policy has found that intensive family preservation services save $2.52 for every dollar spent. So it's a wise investment to put money into this. The other issue, and I think, and I'm sorry, I don't have all the budget options in front of me. I'm not that deeply into the state budget and the proposals. But it's been 5 years since there's been a cost of living increase in these contracted services. And what that means for us in the nonprofit sector is, you know, our employees didn't stop having the cost of living go up, our health insurance costs have gone up, and what we've done is continue to cut into administration and oversight and some of the benefits and so forth that we're able to give to employees, to the point that we've just cut things to the bare bones, and it's affecting our ability to hire and retain staff. So nobody goes into this line of work for the money, but I can say sometimes it's hard to see a 21 or 22-year-old outselling mortgages making twice what a staff person with a master's degree is getting hired in to do these kind of intensive interventions. So I hope when you look at the budget that you will be sure that these kinds of services are adequately funded to do the work and retain the quality staff to provide this important service. In terms of, and then I'll move on so other folks can speak, but I think that the child welfare system in Oregon has done a good job of focusing on kinship care, that there's been a strong philosophy from the top for family preservation. I think that's sincere. I see from upper management through the branch management, everybody is pretty much focused on keeping kids and families together. And I think that the casework staff is committed to the work that they do, the DHS staff. So appreciate your support, and I'll pass this on to my colleagues here.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair Carter, for the record, I'm Lori Schiedler. I'm here today representing the Oregon Foster Parent Association. Don Darlin was not able to attend as he was ill. My husband and I have been foster parents for 8 years, and I'm currently the Vice President of the Marion County Foster Board Association. I'm here to speak to you today on the needs that we have as foster parents in order to be a success with the kids that come into care. The number one thing is respite care. We need respite care for our kids, not just for the ones that qualify for it, but for every child that comes into our home. We could greatly benefit from standardized funded respite care. When you burn out all of your bridges with your family and friends, you need to have somebody that the state has lined up that has already passed the background checks and the fingerprinting that can be there for us to watch some of these troubled kids that we so need a break from.
Tell me what you mean by standardized respite care.
Providers that the state has put on board. Mm-hmm. It may not be anybody that we know, but that they are already approved in our area and ready to go at a call.
Okay.
Yeah.
Senator Wilson.
If I could, there's a bill making its way through the legislature that kind of reinvigorates what Wesley Lewis started in 99, which is very much what the witness is testifying to, not just for foster care, but those with significant, severely medically fragile children, where they make a call in a local area, background checks. Some of these come to the home, some they can take the individuals to. It is a critically lacking component in our variable, in our equation of what services we provide in the home. It's very important. I thank you very much for bringing that up.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just echo the lifespan respite in terms of providing that is something we need to revisit here at the state. So just what Senator Wesson is saying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Westland, I appreciate your thoughts on the liability that we take on as foster parents and the very high needs of the children that we take into our home. My husband and I work with girls who are between the ages of 8 and 18, and they've been diagnosed already with some kind of a behavioral issue. And so we take these girls in one or two at a time. And the liability that comes with them is just so great because of the background that they have been exposed to. That, when the fists start flying, it's all you can do just to protect yourself and keep them safe, let alone, allegations that may come from it. And I appreciate your thought on that part of it as we continue to try and keep these kids safe in our care. Employment-related daycare would be so helpful. If you want quality foster parents to be there taking care of your kids, most of them need to work. I'm very proud to say that we live on a 14-acre farm in Silverton, and I think that that's probably part of the success that we have with our kids is that we have a lot of room for them to, you know, have animals. They're not right on top of neighbors who are bringing in influences into our home. And in order to do that, I need to make sure that the mortgage gets paid. So I have a part-time job. I leave when the school bus leaves my house, and I get back by the time the school bus gets there. But my reimbursement for living expenses for my 8-year-old foster daughter is $13 a day, and that is her three meals. She goes to a school that does not provide a hot lunch. She packs a lunch. It's all of her school clothes, her school supplies. It's you know, things that you don't think about, like replacing a mattress because we take in bed wetters, or, you know, calling the plumber in because they've flushed underwear down the toilet that don't belong there. Sometimes when you have these kids that have these issues, they don't do common sense things, and sometimes it brings extra expenses into our home. I've probably replaced more DVD and VCR players in the 8 years that I've been a foster parent as I did all my life, just because the kids like the buttons and, you know, things get broke. Anyway, as I move on.
Thank you so much. I hope you're going to get to this, maybe comment on the special rates.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. Not only would it be good to see, you know, a cost of living reimbursement for the base rate, but the special rates are also greatly needed for these kids, as the special rate will reimburse you for additional hours that some of these kids need. So what it is above and beyond. So if I have a little girl who's in third grade and she's operating at kindergarten level, a normal third grader may need 20 minutes of help after each school day. She may need an hour and a half. And so it reimburses us for our one-on-one time working with them and their behavior issues and the other needs that they have in the home. And that program is very much in need. Another area that I wanted to touch on is the face-to-face contact with our caseworkers. It's so important for them to be able to have a light enough caseload that they can come out to our home once a month and sit down with us and see the child in our home. The behaviors of these kids can change from week to week, and when one thing isn't working for them, then they'll often switch, and the caseworkers need to know where the child is, what kind of services they need, what kind of safety plans we've implemented in order to make sure that the child is safe. And not only caseworkers, but our certifiers are there to you know, hear our needs. But when they're overloaded, I know my certifier right now works with 106 children, and it's over 30 families. And I have a new certifier who's been with me for 3 months, but I haven't had a chance to meet her yet because I haven't had a crisis in my home and I haven't had an issue. And they're needing to deal with the problems, and it'd be so great if she could just come out and see who we are and what we're about without having there be a problem.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Excuse me. My name is Annie Zander, and I am a parent that was involved with child welfare approximately 8 years ago. My son was born, and when he was 45 days old, he was taken into foster care for the first time. And at that time, I started a relationship with a worker that assessed my situation. I came into contact with DHS because of my addiction issues with drugs and alcohol, and I was rather quickly assessed as having a drug and alcohol problem and sent to a treatment center, along with you know, having to do parenting classes and domestic violence support group, things like that. And I was successful in getting my son back about 5 months after he was taken into care. I after about a year of being involved with child welfare and completing services, my case was dismissed. And when my son was 16 months old, I was brought back into the system because I had relapsed and I had been arrested and I had had my son with me. I was hooked up with the same caseworker, and again, they worked with me to coordinate services to get me back into treatment, to get me back into parenting classes, to help me leave the domestic violence relationship that I had gone back to. And since that time, my life has really came full circle. I work for a program that works with moms who are involved with child welfare, and I'm a mentor. I mentor women who are in the same position that I was when I came into working with child welfare. They're struggling with addiction issues, and they can be at varying levels of whether or not their children are in foster care or, you know, hopefully it's a preventative measure to stop their kids from going into care. The things that, I guess the biggest message that I would like to get across today is about visitation. Because I was a parent that was myself involved with having to do supervised visits, once I graduated from drug and alcohol treatment, once I was in treatment, the treatment center kind of facilitated the visits. You know, my son was transported there, and I'd get him for, like, visits for 8 hours or so a week. And then once I left that treatment center, I was back down to an hour a week visitation in the office. And with the transportation the way that it is now, parents are put on waiting list to actually have their weekly visits if they need to have supervised visits. And I know that for parents that can be quite frustrating, because that one visit may be the one thing that gets them through another week of trying to complete services and get back to where they need to be providing for that child. And I know from my own experience the availability of services. I actually participated in some of OPTIONS programs. Actually, it was Intensive Family Services, which was an in-home counseling program that came into my home and provided counseling for me 1 hour a week. But the availability of those services are steadily going away, and clients really have to meet certain criteria to be able to access services. And so that is one thing that I think is critical. If we don't have the services there to provide the parents to be adequate providers and work through their issues that got them involved with child welfare in the first place, it's kind of an endless battle. And the other issue is making sure that we have access to treatment programs. If I know that the growing number of cases coming into child welfare are drug and alcohol related, and in our communities, I know especially in some of the rural communities, they don't even have residential treatment centers. They have to go to different counties to be able to access treatment. And especially in the county that I live, Multnomah County, we had in the past a Multnomah County ITACS, which funded some treatment facilities. Treatment beds for parents going that needed addiction services, and we no longer have that funding. So, you know, those are things, as I was listening to other people share, could be preventative measures for children actually going into the foster care system if we can access treatment for parents and make sure that they have adequate services that are meeting what their needs are. I think that would be helpful for our families. Any questions?
Congratulations on your doing that.
Madam Chair. Thank you. And thank you for being here. The transportation, could you talk a little bit more? They're waiting list for visitations because...
Because the... Each office, at least in the county where I live, there are what we call SSAs, which transport for supervised visitation, and there are a limited number of SSAs per office, and then the ratio of families that need supervised visitation. So at times, there can be waiting lists waiting for a time slot to open up that would work for the family, that would work for the child's school schedule, which could be a problem, you know, especially if SSAs are sick. You know, then their visits are canceled for that day, and it might be a week or two before parents are getting their weekly visit.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair Carter and committee members, my name is Nicole Dobbins. I'm 23 years old.
a former foster youth who entered care when I was 2 years old and reunified with my mother a few years later. Re-entered at 14 and aged out at 18. So that's my background. I want to start with some strengths of the foster care system from my perspective. The independent living program and services that are being provided is definitely a strength and a need in all communities. And I think that I recently found out that in rural areas, those programs are struggling. The recent strides to gain permanency for all youth, especially teens, is another strength in a national movement or a national strength in the foster care system. And also, funding towards higher education has been recognized and is getting great attention. So those are the things that I think are strengths in the foster care system recently. Some areas that need to be addressed and need significant attention are areas around gaining supports for foster youth. Supports and connections to supportive adults that can be there beyond care, because at the age of 18, we are not prepared to exit the system without any supports from any adults. Another area is poor transition planning and lack of knowledge to the youth transitioning. A statistic is 1 in 5 foster youth are actually homeless within the first year of discharge, and I think that's due to the lack of supports from adults as well as poor transition planning. Some of my recommendations are extending care till the age of 21. Some states have already put that on their agenda, and it's actually being addressed on a national level in May. Better attempts towards connecting youth to extended relatives. For me, in my situation, and I know in a lot of other youth I've talked to, the first thing that we do is go and seek out our relatives after exiting care when we have nobody. And so I think that if there were better strides at connecting ourselves with our extended relatives, our transition would be a lot easier. And I think the biggest thing is, like I said, the supports and connections to supportive adults. But I think when people are asked what are the needs of foster youth, the issue of money and funding is always comes up. But really, I think that it's the support and love that we need from people beyond beyond the age of 18, or being adopted, or having people to talk to and advise. It's more than a monetary thing, and I guess that's my biggest point.
Nicole, I'm one of your greatest supporters. I am so angry that we throw our kids on the street at age 18. I really am. That's one of my pet peeves, and that's one of the areas that, as a matter of fact, Representative Boone and Ms. Baker and all of us are talking about today. And all kids are not ready at 18 to be disconnected. Representative Boone.
Oh, I just wanted to ask Nicole if maybe you've had some family members, but some kids don't. Would it be helpful if you had some sort of mentor program, like Boys and Girls Aid, or I'm going to say the wrong thing, it's Boys and Big Brother and Big Sister, something like that. But if you had like an adult, even somebody fairly near your age, but another support system of mentor you could meet with regularly, like once or twice a week for lunch or something.
Right. And I think that it's really good to have a mentor that has been through the same experience as you, so having former foster youth to maybe be those mentors is a very good idea. And I think you for bringing that up, because I actually work with and did an internship with a nonprofit organization called Foster Club. And that's one of the That's the internship. We bring former foster youth to the state of Oregon. We train these individuals, and then we put on teen conferences around the nation, and it's almost like that. We're mentoring, and the feedback and receptiveness that you get from that is so much different than someone that hasn't been in those shoes. So, yes.
Thank you. That's good. Further questions?
Thank you for being here.
You've done a good job in the time that we've had to be here. And what could happen is that I know you hate to leave without closing, Kevin, but would you, like a few words, if the committee would indulge us for about another 5 minutes? I'd appreciate that so that Honorable Norman and Kevin can close. And panel, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being able to go into homes and help families and also to care for our children.
Chair Carter, members of the committee.
Can you hold a minute? Nicole, before, it's not like for you to stay until the committee's over so I can talk with you, okay? If you don't mind.
I was hoping you weren't going to ask us to follow that group.
Oh. Well, if you have anything you want to say.
I would like to actually acknowledge that Nicole was not sharing with her. She actually graduated from college here not too long ago, so I think that's very important as well. Oregon State University?
Go Beavers.
Beavers. I think that's important to acknowledge her great achievements in that. At this point in time, I would certainly entertain any questions you have other than getting back into the book. We could.
I have to tell you, Representative Cortez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make reference to page 111, where we talk about managing foster care payments. I'd like to revisit that. I don't know when we can do that, but I assume that's the proposed reductions in special rate foster care payments. And I just would like some more explanation of how that came about and what you're thinking and what improvements and why we're doing that. And so maybe you could put something in writing and bring it back to us. Am I getting that right? That's a special rate reduction there? Okay.
Committee, thank you very much for your patience. This has been, again, another afternoon of great testimony, so I want to thank you so much for that. And thank you so much, Ramon, for coming back to the Holder Report, which I think was so very important, and further outline some strategies, and I want to see some outcomes, if you don't mind, from your local partners, because to not have a street line of communication between the Sheriff's Department, the Police Department, and local people who depend on that communication to be so strong so that we won't have so many of our kids falling through the cracks. I don't mean so many, but the ones that do fall through, I'd appreciate that a lot.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Carter.
Thank you very much. Committee dismissed.